Hello and welcome to the Ballot Box global election coverage from a team of political scientists. I'm Jonathan Parker in London.
I'm Chris Terry in Manchester.
I'm Andres Besser in New York City.
Hello everyone and welcome to a new episode of the Ballot Box. Today we're going to cover elections in a small but very interesting island, Malta. I think it's going to be a very good episode. But before we get into the nitty-gritty of this election, let's check in with Chris and Johnny. Chris, you just came back from a relatively long and kind of fascinating holiday. Where did you go, and how do you feel now that you're back?
I went to Italy for just over a week. We landed in Bologna, which allowed me to bore my partner stupid with the history of the Italian Communist Party, which was great for me. Possibly less so for her. In the evening we went to Florence, had a few days there, and then we went to Rome for 4 days, which was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. I highly recommend Italy. I've eaten a lot of very good Italian food and had a great time. And and I'm also engaged now, so that's nice. just dropping that in at the end.
Congratulations.
Yes, wow. Congratulations. Good news.
Thank you.
Great, good. So you went to Italy and you got engaged. That was like an amazing.
It's quality holiday. It was our 10-year anniversary, so look, felt like maybe we would put it around a lot. Plus, things have stabilized from where they were in the last couple of years. Next logical step.
Excellent. That's so great. I doubt Johnny has an equivalent piece of news. I don't think he got engaged.
Little do you know, Andres.
But you never know. So let's check in with
got
Johnny.
Married. nothing dramatic has happened. Semester has ended for us now, so I'm just enjoying my marking.
That
was incredibly sarcastic, Andres. Do not enjoy the marking.
And presumably being a relatively new academic still. Yeah. The afterglow.
The department's Christmas party last Friday, which was very good. Omicron delayed Christmas party, which was the most eventful thing that happened. Which was good, but they made no Christmassy effort for it, which I appreciated, to be honest. How about you, Andres? So I believe you're not in New York. I think this is the first time we're doing this podcast on the same continent, actually.
Yeah, I think it is. I'm in Spain. I came here for a conference and for like a seminar in Murcia, a city in the south of Spain. It's really beautiful. It's been really productive. I love it. It's just kind of weird being, it wasn't long enough to kind of quit New York time. So I've just not been sleeping very much. But other than that, it's been really great. Mm-hmm. Good. So, Malta held a general election on the 26th of March, and the incumbent Labour Party of Prime Minister Robert Abela won another landslide victory. This outcome was never really in doubt, given all polls pointed towards it. The party won 55% of the vote and gained an extra seat, taking its total to 38. The Labour government has been constantly dogged with corruption allegations, most famously the murder of journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia, who had exposed two Labour politicians. This led to the resignation of Prime Minister Joseph Muscat in 2019, who was replaced by Abela. Despite this, Labour cruised for another easy victory over the Nationalist Party. So that's the kind of the headlines, the major context of the election that just took place. Mm-hmm. And I think as you know, is now our custom here at the ballot box, we'll go into the constitutional setup of Malta. But in fact, right before we go into Malta, just, you know, kind of someone who lives on in the new world, I did know where Malta was, and I did kind of know about it, but maybe a kind of an understanding that of the size of the country could be
good
right before entering the constitutional setup.
Yeah, Malta only has a population of less than 500,000. So the least populated country in the EU. And it's also very geographically small. So it's composed of three islands, technically, although the largest is called, or is also called Malta. the smallest island is a nature reserve, only has two people living on it. And then there's Gozo, which has quite a small population. And then Malta proper, which has been described, is increasingly being described now as like almost a city state, because it's actually incredibly densely populated, because it's a very small island, but with a small population, but because of how small the island is, it's still really densely populated. It's I did like a little bit of maths. Malta is about as dense as Sheffield in England. So like a kind of moderately sized English city has a kind of equivalent population density to the country of Malta. So that kind of gives you a sense of the kind of scale that we're talking about. It's also quite distant from things. it's like a volcanic island that's like right in the middle of the Mediterranean. It's not like next door to any country, really. It's fairly distant from everything.
Yeah, well, it's history very much shaped by the two shores, which are just kind of closest to it. So obviously one half. The language is very close to Arabic.
Yes.
It used to be part of the sort of Sicilian emirate in the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. So the language of basic Maltese is Arabic with a lot of like Sicilian and Italian put into it, which dates from the kind of second northern influence from the second kind of period in the Kingdom of Sicily, which is where Catholicism has been integrated. But yeah, it remains quite Arabic like the language, although it is written in the Latin alphabet. But then the third major influence is the British one. This was a British colony up until the 60s, from the early 19th century. If you go, it is a very strange experience that it would be walking down a street which looks very like the south of Italy, and then you'll come across a red phone box and a Marks and Spencers, which is quite a jarring experience to see. But there's still a very clear kind of British influence in there, that English language proficiency is very high still as well.
Yeah, it's an official language. It's an official language as well, although it's kind of treated as like secondary to Maltese. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of British holiday makers go there, and there's a lot of British either second homers or retirees in Malta as well. So something that goes on. So for Brits, there's a kind of clear connection of sorts. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Yes, I was in Malta many years ago. It was absolutely beautiful, and even the architecture is kind of Arabic, in a way. But there were definitely kind of influences of both cultures I could see there. It was fantastic, and people were really, really, really nice.
We're one of the handful of countries that all three of us have been to then. I was there, and I will be channeling in this when I worked for the Electoral Reform Society. I was invited over to Malta to speak at the University of Malta, because they use the electoral system that the ERS has traditionally championed. I'm going to be challenging that experience quite a lot, because I had a lot of very interesting conversations about Maltese politics in that, and learned a lot from just listening to other people that were talking in the kind of lecture series that I was participating in.
Excellent. All right, great. I think that was I think it's an important step before the constitutional setup. So What are the main kind of outlines of the Maltese constitution? What sort of government is it? What sort of,
So it's a parliamentary republic with a kind of ceremonial, indirectly elected president. That's probably the last time we'll mention the president, because the president really isn't an important figure. And the parliament on paper has 65 seats, but in reality very rarely has 65 seats, because there's a system of bonus seats, which I'll kind of explain in a moment. And after this election, it has 67. It can go as high as 69. So Malta's one of only two countries which use STV to elect its lower house, the other one being Ireland. STV is a PR system which involves ranking individual candidates that within kind of multi-member constituencies. So Malta is split up into 13 constituencies with 5 members each, and then people rank their choices, and you're supposed to kind of, and it's the out the way that things work is supposed to kind of produce a kind of proportionality within that. I'm not going to kind of go into great amount of detail because I don't feel like it's actually terribly important, particularly because the Maltese don't tend to use STV in the way that its proponents traditionally imagine that people will use STV, or the way in which it's used in, for example, in Ireland, because the Maltese politics is incredibly polarized, which is something that we're going to kind of probably be talking about a fair bit over this conversation. So what will happen, and what people, proponents of STV, will usually say is, oh, STV is wonderful. People can kind of just vote for candidates rather than parties, but still get kind of proportionality out of it. So you can, for example, if you prefer candidates in different parties, you can vote across party lines. You can choose candidates within parties. You can vote for independents very easily, and you can do all that, but the Maltese don't. It's the simple reality of it. Maltese parties will quite often produce very long lists of candidates, precisely because they know that voters will just turn up and literally just take their party's candidates and just vote, and vote all the way down the list for that party, and then go. They won't cast preferences for any other party. Only about historically, I don't know if this is still true, because I think where I saw this was pulling from almost 20 years ago now. But historically, only about 1% of people in Malta cast preferences over the line. When I was at that Maltese lecture series, said to me that they don't think that the Maltese voter even knows that that's something that they can do. the way that the Maltese think about their democracy is very much that fundamentally almost treating it like a kind of list system, albeit the STV component does play an important role in terms of people do take voting within the parties quite seriously, and candidates within the parties do campaign against each other to some extent. Obviously, they're limited by the ties of party bonds, but there is kind of a competition within parties.
Are the parties quite like fractious then, if this is going on, or not?
Not especially from what I understand, but there are kind of, there are sometimes fractious elements. There is often, particularly given it's such a small country, there's often like a few people within each party who are essentially troublemaking for some reason or another. So for example, a very good example is Dom Mintoff, who we'll probably talk about a little bit. Anyway, Dom Mintoff was an incredibly long-running leader of the Labour Party. He was leader of the party for decades. all the way from before independence, all the way through to the 80s. And he, after he left the leadership of the party, he continued on as an MP for another decade. And then being a complete pain in the ass to the, in the most academic language possible, to the Labour leadership. And then in 1998, brought down a very short-term Labour government, but that only had a majority of one. Because that kind of thing can and does happen because Malta often has very close results because the polarisation is ridiculously strong. In fact, the last three elections have been the three biggest wins in Maltese history. most of the time, parties are only only beating each other by like a 2-3 percentage points. That closeness does provide some opportunity for troublemaking. But most of the time, the parties get here quite well. I would say that the personal factor is probably actually most important in terms of there's not really a nice way of saying this, graft. There's a clientelist component to Maltese politics, which is very strong. Maltese politicians frequently use their position to try and kind of win gains for their constituents, for their supporters within their constituencies, etc., etc.
So it's a country with extensive use of STV, but where STV isn't really playing a big role in the election the way that voters are approaching the election.
Perhaps not in the way that it would traditionally be understood. So I think STV is playing a role in terms of, you know, there's a lot of stuff written about how STV increases the utility of constituency focus, for instance, compared to our PR systems. So in that kind of terms, that kind of personal aspect, that kind of graph, the slightly clientelist aspects of Maltese politics, STV is probably playing a role. It's not playing a role in terms of, you know, the proportional representation aspect isn't resulting in a multi-party system. This is an incredibly bipolar political system. Malta has essentially, since independence, has simply never had an MP that wasn't in some way affiliated to one of the parties elected at a general election. The closest you've got is there was a kind of third party at the 2017 election, which was allied to one of the parties, which got a couple of seats that way. But aside from that, they've simply not elected any third parties. People just simply don't cast votes across party lines, even though that's theoretically an option. And that's now being reinforced by the electoral system as well, I would say, in terms of Malta has kind of edited STV to have this system of bonus seats, which I referenced before. So essentially, because of the polarization, it was incredibly controversial in 1981 when the Labour Party won a majority of seats, despite having lost the popular vote, which quite frankly was because Dom Mintoff, he gerrymandered the electoral system. As simple as that. It was fairly obvious that that is a thing that he had done. So the Nationalist Party, which is the Labour Party's primary opponent, attempted to boycott Parliament, caused kind of constitutional crisis. So before the next election, there was an agreement made to change the constitution so that to guarantee that whoever won the popular vote would win a majority in Parliament. So at that point, the system was made so that whoever won the popular vote, if they hadn't won a majority, they would get bonus seats until they had a majority of one. That's subsequently been changed so that the bonus seats system now comes into force, regardless of whether you win or lose, to try and create a kind of closer proportionality within the two parties, which runs into polarization and clientelism, in my view, because the polarization between these two parties is so strong, and the clientelism so strong, that there's a kind of sense of trying to balance the two parties as closely as possible to what their vote was, so that they kind of feel like they're kind of getting as equal the kind of correct share out of the system, both in terms of access to pork and so on, and also in terms of just being as close to each other as possible. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would say that that system is an interesting one, because it fundamentally makes the system more proportional in terms of these two parties now more closely represent each other, but it reinforces the idea of this big bipolar contests. It makes it the case that your vote matters in terms of your first preference, as well as now deciding who your local representative is going to be, is now essentially also being thrown into a kind of big national first past the post pot, which is deciding which party wins the kind of national contest.
We also talk, I guess, about smallness of countries sometimes affecting the size of the party system as well. So that, yeah, like it's not too, I mean, obviously a two-party system is not really expected under a proportional system, but also is a very small country, and tend to think of them with having fewer cleavages, etc., and fewer parties arising generally as well. So maybe we shouldn't be as, especially with the kind of features of the electoral system that we've discussed and the clientelism, too surprised that we have this two-party system as well.
Yeah, and it's worth kind of briefly discussing the kind of ways in which the two-party system is reinforced kind of external to that as well. So yeah, there are very few numbers of cleavages in Malta. It's a fairly homogenous society. It's ethnically homogenous. It's traditionally been religiously homogenous in terms of everyone is basically a Catholic in Malta. It's an incredibly religious society. Even now, I mean, it's secularizing fairly rapidly, but even now the latest figures I could find said that, which I just looked up this morning, actually, because I thought, oh, that's probably actually a useful thing to check. Church attendance is still at about 36%, which is far lower than it historically was in Malta, but is still high for Europe. So it's still a fairly religious society. There's something of a secular religious cleavage, I think it's fair to say. Traditionally, the Labour Party has had a kind of slight anti-clericalism for a very long time. A kind of big issue of contention on the island was who should run the education system, the church or the state. Arguments like that. There is a real class cleavage as well, which is also part of the distinction between, essentially the Labour Party is obviously, it's a Labour Party, it's a party of the, you know, notionally at least, of the working class. The Nationalist Party, their opponents, is kind of a Christian Democratic Party. It's close to the Catholic Church. It's traditionally been seen as, you know, both a party of the middle class, but also a party of the church. And sometimes the church has itself been seen as a kind of middle class institution in Malta. The class and religious secular cleavage are kind of running into each other in Malta, quite in a way that perhaps a don't necessarily do in other countries. It's also the case that because Malta is so dense and so small, it's very, everyone gets to know each other. And Malta also has cultural aspects, which means that everyone gets to know each other too. So, for example, a kind of distinct feature of Maltese society is festas, feasts. So, like, traditionally on Catholic feast days, villages in Malta will organize big village feasts where everyone kind of comes together and, you know, shares food and, you know, and just eats outside together. And this is something that the Maltese are see as kind of a huge part of their society, and who they are. And obviously that kind of communal eating means it makes it very easy for people to get to know each other, even more so than kind of all the kind of aspects of, you know, this is a fairly isolated island. and as I say, small and densely populated. So what I got told by someone when I was at the lecture series was we were talking about why Maltese turnout is so high. So Malta has historically had the highest turnouts in Europe, despite not having compulsory voting. So Belgium has compulsory voting, and despite that, Malta has a higher turnout than Belgium does. Typically, it's been high, north of 90%. And what someone there told me was, well, you know, on polling day, because the activists know everyone and know who everyone votes for, once it gets past about lunchtime, you'll see them outside the polling stations just phoning people up and going, hey, you know it's election day. you're gonna come and vote. you're gonna come support our guys. So the Maltese parties are incredibly large, incredibly sizable. And the activists are very sophisticated, but also everyone knows each other. And as that kind of hints, there's also a kind of polarization in Malta. So people, you know, traditionally people haven't moved votes very often. There's obviously a very small group which has, and that has generally been why most elections have been won or lost, like where that kind of swing group is going. But historically, Maltese elections have been incredibly stable in terms of the outcome until before 2013, which was when Labour came to power. The largest gap ever between the two parties is only about 5%. since the independence era, anyway, the pre-independence era was a little bit more complicated. So most people were just voting for the same party every single time. Since 2013, you've seen much larger gaps, which I think is, and also slightly declining turnouts as well, which I think is probably hinting at there might be a kind of sort of Maltese partisan de-alignment happening, where people are kind of moving away from their kind of traditional party. And becoming a little bit more volatile. It'd be interesting to kind of, obviously there isn't much political science done on Malta because it's so small, but it'd be interesting to see some research on that.
Please
carry on. I've just been rambling for a while.
given that we're kind of talking about the interaction between the kind of electoral system, party system, and characteristics of Malta, I wanted to recover two things in the show notes. Mm. One is that there was this concept, polarization, and thinking about a suggestion that Malta could be thought of as an example of polarization. What is that, and like how would that help us
understand? No, polarization is a term that comes out of Dutch politics, and it's basically one I've imposed on Malta. No one else has used that term about Malta, as far as I understand. It's just like a comparison that comes to mind. But historically, in the Netherlands, there was quite famously a kind of self-segregation of sorts into these things called pillars, which were to do with religion and party obligation. So Protestant, there were for example, Protestants had different hobbies, they had different schools, they had different universities, they had different TV channels, they had different media outlets to Catholics. Socialists had their own pillar, and there was something that was sometimes referred to as a general pillar, where liberals, which in the Netherlands is a kind of middle class secularist ideology, also kind of de facto had their own pillar, because even though they're theoretically against polarization, all the kind of everything, they were the only ones left. So like they kind of ended up being in their own. Malta has something new. As someone who isn't really an expert on Malta, but it feels to me like Malta has something quite similar in terms of people are very intensely attached to parties. There are media outlets which are literally ran by the political parties. Both Maltese parties have a kind of media arm attached to them, which owns, in both cases, TV channels, radio stations, and newspapers. There are other, broadcasters. There are other media outlets in Malta, but most of them attached to one party or the other. The public broadcasting is typically seen as leaning to whichever party is in power at the time. So there's a kind of sense that although there's not segregation, I think it's probably fair to say, people do talk to each other within across party lines. There's a kind of very intense separation in terms of some habits, in terms of the way that people, supporters of one party and the other, and everyone in Malta kind of very strongly, and traditionally people in Malta have very strongly aligned with one party or the other. I saw an article which described Malta as a country where politics is the national hobby, because politics kind of runs into everything in Malta. This kind of stuff does happen in small countries. We discussed Cyprus last year, which has something a little bit similar, like small island nations where are places where it's very easy for this kind of organization to happen, because communities become very kind of interlocking and very kind of inward looking. So yeah, it's understandable. Yeah, I hope that explains things.
That does. Is there anything else we want to talk about in background? I mean, there's several things that we left out from the show notes, but I think the general contours are there, and it's about obviously STV, the colonial history, the size, and how the size reflects on politics. You also talked about clientelism, which I think is important in Malta. Mm. Something that's not in the show notes, and maybe it's something that you might not want to talk about or might want to talk about is, you know, how bad is, and obviously, oh, you also talk about the polarization, right, in the two-party system. How bad is corruption, and what, you know, what happened to the journalist who, I mean,
yeah,
was the case of Daphne Caruana Galizia ever resolved? That's a really dark episode for Europe. I mean, it feels like it must have had a lot of kind of, I don't know, influence on Maltese politics.
Yeah. Well, in terms of corruption, as I said, clientelism has kind of frequently been seen as kind of running through Maltese society. And there have been and that is something that's kind of dogged Maltese society quite a lot. So if I had a look at like the Freedom in the World, Freedom House, for us is something that's well known, but just to kind of broadly explain this to our listeners, Freedom in the World is a report that is written every year by a US organization called Freedom House about the state of democracy and freedom and civil liberties in countries around the world. And so I really like Freedom House, those reports, because they because Freedom House produces an article on every single country in the world every year about those things within it. And also one thing that Freedom House does, which I really like, is it kind of gives you kind of great qualitative insight while they've given countries scores and different things, and really kind of lays out kind of all the different elements of what they're presenting. Freedom House is really positive about Malta in general. It's got a 90 out of 100, which is really in the kind of top realms of democracy. It's like up with the UK and France, really. So it's, you know, a mature, advanced democracy. But one of the places where it does fall down is the question on, are safeguards against official corruption strong and effective, for which Malta only has a 2 out of 4. There have been kind of consistent efforts to safeguard against corruption, which have frequently failed. And that simply runs into the fact that Maltese politics is so clientelist, in my view, and it is not specifically to do with any one party, which is perhaps to some extent why it continues to happen, because, you know, there isn't an anti-corruption option per se, or at least not one that's easily capable of getting elected. So it continues to dog Maltese politics for that reason. What happened with Daphne Caruana Galizia was incredibly hideous. She'd been investigating the Panama Papers, which had been an incredibly big deal in Malta because they had revealed extensive corruption and allegations about Maltese officials, and including all the way up until the Prime Minister's office, cabinet ministers, and she had been a long time passionate anti-corruption campaigner in Malta. And she wasn't just killed, she was killed in a car bomb, which, as ways of being assassinated, is, you know, an incredibly visible one. And if someone's clearly putting a lot of effort in, if they're willing to car bomb you. So that was incredibly hideous and incredibly sad, and because of the fact that these investigations were going on, figures obviously started to point to quite powerful people within Maltese politics. And as far as I'm aware, nothing has been resolved. Things haven't been resolved yet, but investigations that have been ongoing have featured people within the former Prime Minister Joseph Muscat, Muscat's office, and he actually ended up resigning from the Prime Ministership due to members of his staff being questioned by the police in regards to that. I don't really know enough about details about the police investigation to say exactly what's going on there, but it's very clear to me that very large numbers of people believe that that there is a connection between the murder and former members of Muscat's team. It's quite frankly, I think, the fairest way I can put it.
That was well put, and it's a difficult. No, I realize it's a difficult thing to kind of. I don't know, to talk about, given that there's little like official information either way. There's a lot of
and obviously because these investigations are still ongoing, there's a lot that's still not in the public domain. But certainly, the public, there have been public protests about this. Carina Iglesias was incredibly popular in Malta, and people have been incredibly passionate about that. There have a businessman who was accused, has been accused of orchestrating her murder, and then claimed after afterwards that that Muscat was aware of the plot. This is someone who's been arrested, so it might be leveling accusations, but there's obviously a sense that something was going on there. And Malta has had kind of continual long-running problems with money laundering and all sorts of other nastiness, which I'd say runs into the clientelism of the political of politics in Malta.
I mean, it's developed a reputation since EU membership of as a place where rich foreigners can purchase an EU passport quite easily.
Which we discussed in Cyprus, because Cyprus had the exact same thing and is obviously very similar as an island nation. And that was also a cause of kind of big problems of corruption in Cyprus. I think, although they're very different in huge numbers of ways, Cyprus is a much more diverse society, famously so, and has a multi-party system. There are kind of elements of both which are obviously similar, and the fact that they're kind of similar kind of geographies is obviously part of what's going on there. Really, that stuff is all fairly hideous, and corruption has continued to dog the Labour Party in this election, because something that the Nationalist Party is now trying to contest is that essentially the Labour Party, so in Malta you get tax rebates around the spring, and this year those tax rebates got sent out the earliest they ever got sent. So the Nationalist Party is accusing the Labour Party of attempting to bribe the electorate using those tax rebates. The Labour Party also, in some cases, I understand, attached checks to election leaflets, different checks for essentially for paying for petrol. Obviously, the energy crisis is hitting Malta as it's hitting most of Europe right now.
So wait a second, just to get this clear. The government, so checks went out and they were attached to leaflets.
So this is two separate sets of checks. So I should probably be clear about that. One set of checks is a check from the state, which which is kind of a classic kind of Maltese policy of to do with tax rebates that happens around spring each year, which has gone out early in this case. The earliest it's ever gone out, so the Nationalist Party has
there's a reason incumbents are hard to beat.
Exactly. The other set of checks as ones from the party, but which have been attached to election leaflets in a way that in the UK, for example, would very clearly be labelled by the Electoral Commission as treating, essentially attempting to vote by votes.
Yeah, but why could parties send checks?
So the police have said that this isn't a violation of Maltese electoral law. So I don't know enough about electoral law in Malta to be sure.
There's a limit to your expertise, and we've encountered one of those few times when.
That makes sense. But the police have said that isn't a violation of the electoral law. But very clearly in most countries that would be considered vote buying.
Right. No, of course. So there was obviously the murder of the journalists that then brought on a change of prime minister, but it was still the Labour Party. And now there's like this kind of Czech scandal. There's probably been other scandals too.
Yes.
It's kind of surprising that the Labour Party is still so popular. Despite all of these, I don't know what to call it, suspicious moves, shady way of like doing politics.
Yeah.
So why is the Labour Party still popular in Malta?
Well, I think that runs into a few things. I mean, first of all, is their opponents, to be quite frank. So the Nationalist Party, I don't know so much about the Nationalist Party historically and at present as I do about the Labour Party, to be quite honest. But given Maltese clientelism, very clearly it's not the case that the Nationalist Party is seen as like a clean party either. And it was in power for a very long period before the Labour was in power. That element has is clearly something that goes on behind the scenes. Another thing with the Nationalist Party has also been quite internally disorganized, is my sense, over the kind of recent period of Labour power. There's been a fair bit of infighting, from what I understand. Their leader had to resign after the 2019 European elections, and so they've changed leader midterm, and there've been kind of ructions against the current one. So the party and the party's been kind of struggling to kind of redefine itself. Another issue is social reform. Maltese society, I think, is changing quite rapidly. As we discussed earlier briefly, Maltese society is very religious even now by European standards, but it's secularizing fast. Church attendances are dropping really quickly. The society is clearly. It is having kind of a social revolution, I guess, of sorts, I guess. So a little more than 10 years ago, Malta was a country where divorce was illegal. It was one of three countries in the world where divorce was still illegal, the other two being at the time, the Philippines and Vatican City.
Great company. Anytime your country is listed along with the Vatican,
yes,
alarm bells should ring.
So 2 years before Labour came to power, there was a referendum held on whether divorce should be illegal, which passed relatively narrowly, and so divorce became legal. Since Labour came to power, Malta has become a country with incredibly good LGBT rights. So the ILGA, which is an organization which basically measures LGBT rights around the world, now ranks Malta number one in Europe. of 49 countries in Europe. Malta has same-sex marriage, it has incredibly good sets of LGBT rights. Strange, possibly a little bit kind of confusingly with that, Malta is still a country where abortion is illegal. So obviously there are limits to that social liberalisation, but Labour has really pushed LGBT rights, and that kind of clearly ties into the secularisation of Maltese society. So I think that the other element that I think is important to note is that Malta's economy is doing really well. Malta's economy has been doing fantastically under Labour. Maltese economic growth has been consistently strong. I think actually the strongest in Europe, essentially because Malta has kind of leveraged its position as this small city-state within the EU since joining the European Union to basically act as a kind of low tax place where people can base industry. So for example, the games industry, video games and software development are becoming big things in Malta. A friend of mine's dad works on Malta as a games developer. As well as kind of things like banking and, you know, all the things that small countries tend to kind of really excel in. And so, and Labour has used that position, yes, to some extent for corruption and pork, but also for, you know, building up infrastructure, for doing kind of fairly progressive things in terms of like the welfare state. For example, they've been pushing childcare quite a lot forwards. Yes, there is corruption. Yes, there is, you know, some fairly hideous stuff that perhaps, which seems actually kind of really extreme, but it's well worth remembering that the experience of the average person on the street is that their life, that their standard of living has been increasing under Labour. It's as simple as that. You might be worried that like the former Prime Minister might be involved in kind of really shady stuff, but at the same time, hey, you're getting richer, you're getting better benefits, public services are getting better. If you're one of the increasingly large number of people in Malta with a kind of secular mindset, you know, the country is liberalizing socially. There's a lot of positive. So there is, you know, a positive experience in those regards, and people, you know, it's very easy, I think, in those circumstances for people to go, hey, corrupt cooks, but at least these corrupt cooks are making my life better. I think that's a major element of why Labour wins, and doesn't just win, but I mean, as I say, these are the three biggest, the three wins it's had since 2013 are the biggest wins in Maltese history, and I think this is actually technically the biggest of those. It's understandable if possibly a little bit disquieting about, you know, democracy.
I think before we move on to some of the campaign and the results, maybe a brief mention of the third party in Malta as well. Like, yeah, there is one notable third party we should cover very briefly.
Yeah, his leader I've actually met because he was in the audience for that lecture series I participated in. It's a party that's just now calling itself AD plus PD. Because it's a merger of two parties with different origins, but related ones. So the first older part was the Democratic Alternative, which has historically been Malta's big third party. Democratic Alternative originated in a split in the Labour Party in the late 80s. From a group of kind of more reformist Labour politicians who felt that the Labour Party wasn't changing fast enough. When Labour left power in 1984, it left power under a kind of air of a fairly authoritarian legacy under its former leader Dom Mintoff, who did some fairly nasty things in power, as well as, you know, a lot of social reform. He's got a very controversial legacy in Malta, but for example, he at one point suspended the Constitutional Court, which is not a thing that generally I would look kindly on. So that was a group that was kind of saying, hey, we need to kind of push more forwards on social liberalism, and we need to push more forwards on anti-corruption measures. And so the Democratic Alternative has been a kind of socially liberal green party that campaigns on corruption issues quite a lot, and typically gets about 1-2% of the vote, typically does better in European elections. In Malta's first ever European election, got 9% of the vote, has never managed to win a seat at the national level or at the European level, because even though it got 9% of the vote, Malta doesn't have many seats, so just missed out. That party has been and partially it's worth mentioning briefly as well. STV does create a kind of barrier to the party in that although the system is proportional overall, within an individual constituency, you need to get about 17% of the vote in order to be able to get a seat. And because Malta is quite homogenous, there isn't really like an area of strength that the Democratic Alternative has. It's not like a country that has, for example, like if it was a larger country, there might be like a kind of a constituency that was like clearly identifiable as like the liberal constituency that could kind of build up its vote in. But because Malta is so small, it doesn't really have that. But it's been a presence. Its leader, you know, gets media attention. Its current leader is actually a former Nationalist Party member. And the party kind of maintains a position as a kind of relatively respected third force that can kind of voice some concerns that perhaps other parties don't. So it's important in times in a media role, I think probably would be fair to say. The second part of this party, the PD, originates from a splinter, for another splinter of the Labour Party, an MP for the party who was a kind of frequently slightly outspoken member of the Labour Party, and who'd actually been a member of the Nationalist Party and an MP for the Nationalist Party before she'd been a member of the Labour Party, split off, essentially actually over allegations of corruption. And then she And then she, so she became a kind of relatively significant figure. And the PD under her did enjoy some a brief element of popularity, albeit it was a kind of similar position to the early Democratic Alternative. It didn't look like it could take seats on its own. So for the 2017 election, there was an attempt made by the Nationalist Party to kind of create, because the Nationalist Party was kind of weak and not particularly popular on its own, there was an attempt made to make an alliance with both the Democratic Alternative and the PD to kind of run as a kind of joint force. Mm-hmm. That could therefore have a little bit of kind of an anti-corruption edge to it. And that was kind of the hope, to kind of try and take Labour out of power. The Democratic Alternative essentially walked out of those talks, but the PD agreed to it, and the campaign together was as an alliance called Democratic Force, and the PD won 2 MPs that way, including its original founder, who Marlene Fruger, which I should have mentioned. So she continued on as an MP, but by then it was increasingly clear that the PD wasn't really viable as a kind of separate force, and she seemed to kind of become less interested in politics, and so she left the party leadership, and the PD, you know, was kind of seen as a kind of slightly failed experiment. So it merged into the AD, with the AD, created this party called AD plus PD. But I mean, I would really say that this is now really just a continuation of the AD. The former AD leader is the merged party's leader. And in terms of this election, it's essentially had the classic AD result. So it doesn't really strike me that the party has, it really just feels like the PD is kind of folded into the AD, and that's effectively what we're left with. It would be nice, I think, if this third force could get a position in Maltese politics, that some actual representation. But alas, it is what it is. The country is just too polarized at the moment. But maybe with time, given the signs that exist of partisan de-alignment in Malta, perhaps the party will get somewhere at some point.
Is there anything else about this campaign in particular we should mention before we discuss the results?
I think it's possibly worth mentioning that environment came onto the mm-hmm. agenda quite a bit. The Labour Party was essentially had an environmentally focused campaign, which, you know, runs is becoming a priority around lots of the world. Labour, it's also an interesting campaign. The campaign also didn't get very much attention, in part, I think, because the result was seen as such a foregone conclusion, especially in contrast to historical Maltese results, which, because things were historically always quite close, it always felt a little bit, there was always a kind of sense that things were being contested. Even when you had, I mean, Nationalist Party was effectively in power before this stretch of Labour power for 2.5 decades. There was like 2 years in the middle where the Labour Party was in power, but really long stretch in power. But those elections always felt quite competitive, because even though Labour was out of power, it was only losing elections by like somewhere between 1% and 4% of the vote. This period of Labour being in power feels a lot more dominant because of the fact that it's now winning by more than 10 points, which for Malta is a historic landslide. absolutely ludicrous win, the likes of which have never been seen. That kind of element is certainly, but the other thing that's going on is obviously the war in Ukraine has taken attention off of Maltese politics. As it has in most countries. When I was in Italy, I saw like a whole bunch of like when I was in Bologna, I saw camps that were set up to welcome refugees, and I saw protesters on the streets of Rome protesting it for favor of Ukraine. So it's really interesting just to have a kind of sense of like how this is, particularly because Italy has historically been one of the most pro-Russian EU members. How this is kind of impacting European politics.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that we've kind of mentioned the results quite a lot anyway. I think the thing to note was that the turnout was the lowest ever. It was still 86%, but it was low for Maltese standards.
I think yes, once again that probably hints, but both for that issue with like the campaign not getting much attention, but I think it also hints at partisan de-alignment in Malta. I think that's probably the best way of putting it. It's not fragmentation, obviously, because new parties are not rising up, but it does seem like the Maltese electorate is becoming less attached to the parties than there was, both in terms of, they're willing to give landslides like this now, which suggests that there's now a bigger kind of group of swing voters between the main two parties. But also we've had the last two elections have been the lowest turnout elections in Maltese history, still astronomically high by European standards. But the fact that, you can now go as low as 86%, suggests that there's now an electorate that doesn't feel like that elections are a ride or die contest where I have to turn out and vote for my chosen party. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I think that's everything for Malta.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So we'll wrap up there then. For that. Obviously, the next one is the big Hungarian contest. So very excited for that. Well, I don't know if excited is the right word for that one. We will be back to discuss that sometime soon.